You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, Cubs edition. MLB.com's Mark Feinsand recently caught up with Cubs Executive Vice President and General Manager Jed Hoyer to discuss his days with the Red Sox, his decision to leave San Diego to rejoin Theo Epstein in Chicago, what Chris Bryant might do as a follow-up act to his MVP season, and what might have happened if the Red Sox had traded for Alex Rodriguez.
So, Jed, you were 28 when you landed your first job in pro baseball,
yeah.
Internship with the Red Sox. Was a career in baseball always your goal, or was that something that sort of hit you in your late 20s?
Yeah, it was always a goal. I always tell people that, you know, if I could do it again, I'd be a lot more persistent than I was. You know, I applied for a lot of jobs when I first got out of college. And didn't, you know, sort of sent letters, didn't really go about it the right way. Definitely wasn't dogged enough in my pursuit of that of a job. And then ended up, you know, having a bunch of different jobs over the next 4 or 5 years. And, you know, kind of found out about this internship with the Red Sox, you know, through a friend. I knew Ben Charrington. We played against each other in college. And kind of that presented itself, and I went after it really hard. So the answer is, yeah, I always wanted to do this. I don't think I knew exactly how to go after it. You know, I think pre-Moneyball, there wasn't sort of an awareness that people like me, you know, were being sought out for jobs like this in some ways, you know. So, yeah, if I could do it again, I'd be a lot more dogged, and maybe I would have gotten in at 22, 23. But I actually think that the jobs I had helped me advance quicker, you know, because of some of the skills I learned in other jobs. So I guess it worked out well in the end, but I definitely didn't take the most direct route at it.
You once said of that Red Sox internship, quote, "I'll look at it as grad school, take on debt for a couple of years, and if it works, great. If not, I'll have no regrets." That seems like a pretty big roll of the dice, no?
Yeah, I mean, I was working as a consultant at the time, and I remember talking to Ben Charrington on the phone in my apartment and, you know, offering me an internship for $8 an hour. And, you know, he could have offered me nothing. I would have just taken on debt and done it. You know, at that point, I kind of looked at it as my one chance, you know. I knew how rare it was to have this opportunity, and I was going to grab it. And the financial part of it wasn't going to be something I was going to consider. So, yeah, I took the $8 an hour, and I've always been proud of the fact that, you know, I sort of got the job and said, all right, I'm going to make this work. And after me, they ended up using a stipend. They ended up using a stipend for paying interns instead of hourly, because I logged so many hours that I actually made decent money. So I was proud of that. But, yeah, it was a roll of the dice, but at the time it really felt like, I have to do this. I have to take this chance. This is what I want to do.
You had a successful career, Division III Wesleyan, as a player. You played in the Cape Cod League with guys like Mark DeRosa, mm-hmm. John McDonald. Does that playing experience, not big league playing experience, obviously, but does that playing experience help you relate to players a little better?
I think so. I think playing, you know, I wasn't good enough to play professionally. You know, I always think to myself, like, listen, there's no replacement for standing on a mound or standing in shortstop in front of 50,000 people and doing it. And there's no, you'd never say that there is. But I do think just because, you know, like, the reason I didn't play in the big leagues wasn't because I didn't want to or didn't think about baseball all the time or didn't care enough. I simply wasn't physically talented enough, right? And so I do think, you know, playing a ton as a kid helps. I coached in college for 3 years after. And I think that really helped me look at the game from a different perspective. So I always think to myself, there's no replacement for the intensity of playing in the big leagues. There's no replacement for the experiences that gives. But I do think there's plenty of people that have jobs like mine that, you know, spent their whole childhood playing. You know, they spent their whole all their 20s dedicated to it. So I do think that. Just because you weren't talented enough to play in the big leagues doesn't mean you didn't think about baseball just as much as those who did.
Do you need to have that passion? It seems like a lot of the guys that I've spoken to for this project topped out in college ball.
Yeah.
Played a year in the minors and then
was sure.
And then chose to pursue a career in the front office. Does that passion for the game that you had as a player, even though you weren't physically talented enough, do you need that passion to embark on this kind of career?
I think you do. I think that I tell people that we interview all the time, like, this is all baseball all the time. You know, that's it. So if you better love it. You better know when you come into work every day, that's all we're talking about. That's all we're trying to figure out. You know, that it's because you like watching a game at night, or it's because you're kind of into it. Like, no, this is it. This is all we do. And so, to me, unless you absolutely love the game, it's not going to, this, you're going to top out at some level. Because there's going to be someone else that's going to read more reports, that's going to watch more video, that's going to care more. And, you know, ultimately, we need an office of all people that this is what we want to do. And, but I think that goes not only for our jobs, I think it goes for players too. You know, that, I definitely know some players that I've been around over the course of my career that didn't love baseball. They were just so physically talented that they overcame it, and they would admit that. But I think the guys that truly love the game, that think about it all the time, that think about how to improve all the time, that talk about it all the time, I think those guys go really far. And I do think that's something you want to look at, you know, during the evaluation process.
During your early time with the Red Sox, you got experience in player development, major league scouting, quantitative analysis, advanced scouting. Did one area draw you in as something that you either felt you were better at or that you liked more?
The way that, the way my career sort of evolved, I got, Theo kind of grabbed me pretty early on, and I was working on the major league transaction side with him from a pretty early stage. I think I did like having a little bit of a macro view of things, and that's the sort of the way my career happened to trend. It wasn't so much that I didn't love scouting, didn't love player development, because I do, and I still as much as I can be involved in those things, I am. But the way my path happened to go, led me to kind of working on the major league transaction side more than anything else, and I love it. It's been wonderful. But it wasn't sort of my passion that pushed me there. It was the sort of circumstances that did.
Ben Charrington once joked that the Red Sox in 2002, quote, felt like a startup when new ownership took over. Did the franchise need that kind of reboot, do you think?
In 2002? I think so, yeah. I think that at the time, 2001 had been a really ugly season chapter for the Red Sox. Very negative clubhouse, and this sort of the overall vibe around the team was not positive. I don't think it was a destination at that point. And I think at that moment it did. I think that it was it had been a relatively small front office. I think front offices were smaller then, and the Red Sox had a small front office even by industry standards at that point. And so, and some of those people left, before we got there. So, I've always said that, to me, one of the best things that happened in my career was simply being hired by the Red Sox. There was this opportunity everywhere, because it had been such a small front office that, people that were titled interns, were forced to do so many things that were kind of above our experience level because we didn't have a lot of people. Now people that came on 5 years later came into a much fuller front office with much less upward mobility. But I look at, other people that were hired around the time I was hired with the Red Sox, and I think what's helped a lot of us is just we were able to sort of have outsized opportunity early on because of the small size of the front office when we got there.
We all know about the trip that you and Theo and Larry Lucchino took to see Curt Schilling in Arizona, Thanksgiving of 2003.
Yeah.
Stayed for Thanksgiving. When Schilling agreed to that trade to come to Boston, did you guys have the sense that that was the piece that was going to put you guys over the edge?
I think we felt really good. We knew we'd beaten out the Yankees to get Schilling. It was really a sort of two-team race to get him. And, we knew how much the Yankees were kind of waiting in the wings, hoping that our deal fell apart so they could jump in. And at that stage, it was Red Sox versus Yankees. And it was, I felt like our off seasons were just sort of spent trading punches back and forth, and I always tell people, people always talk about the Thanksgiving with Schilling. Theo and I were 3 weeks later, Theo and I were in New York meeting with A-Rod for two nights, and I remember the feeling I had, I think it was like the day before I left for spring training, being in the office and finding out that the Yankees were that had acquired A-Rod, and that it felt like that was their punch right back, you know, and it felt like that was just the nature of that era. And, you know, I've kind of accepted the fact that I don't know if I'll ever experience anything like that with the two teams going back and forth like that. It was a wild experience and a wild way to kind of start the early part of my career.
I know this is usually something for us media types to do. Do you ever think of what would have happened if the A-Rod to Boston trade had actually happened?
It's interesting to think about for sure. You know, I think the second part of that deal that no one talked about was, you know, the fact that we were giving up, you know, we were getting to give up Lester. And that would have certainly had a effect later on down the road, more in 07 and 13 than it did early on. I don't know. You know, at the time, A-Rod was the best player in baseball. He was playing shortstop and hitting 50 home runs. Obviously, Manny was a huge part of those teams. So I don't know. I think it's easy to say 04 would have. The easy answer is that 04 wouldn't have happened because, you know, it would have been a different mix. But I think Alex played pretty well in Boston as well. So, you know, who knows? I don't think we have any idea. But it's kind of wild to think about now. And it was a different era for transactions. You know, there was very few big markets back then. And so when a player like that was available, it was one of a handful of teams that even could be considered a possibility. So when I look back at an offseason where we traded Nomar, you know, we had to deal with Nomar for Magley Ordóñez to the White Sox. You know, we get Curt Schilling in a trade, and we trade for A-Rod and have it blow up. You know, you sign Keith Foulke. It's just the kind of deals you were able to go after at that point. It was just, like I said, there were fewer suitors. There were fewer options for those players. So it really was a wild time to work for the Red Sox.
Besides, if the A-Rod trade had happened, he wouldn't have been there to get in the fight with Varitek, and then who knows, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and that's one of the moments. Whenever I think back on that season, I mean, people forget. You know, we were a 500 team for May, June, and that part of July, and really a frustrated team. And I've always felt like, even though we didn't really get hot for a few weeks after, I always felt like that fight with the Yankees was important and probably pretty symbolic. Just like Tampa fought us in 2008 in April with Shields and Coco, and I thought that was very symbolic for them. And it's not something you want to recommend, but I felt like Tampa felt like, hey, enough, these guys have been kicking us around too long. And I think we kind of felt like that way with the Yankees as well.
As a New Englander raised in New Hampshire, what was it like to be a part of the group that helped end that curse?
Yeah, you know, and obviously it was incredible. You know, growing up in that area, knowing how much it meant, not just to Boston or Massachusetts, but to the entire region. And that's one thing that's really cool about working for a truly regional team. You know, anywhere you go all over New England, there's Red Sox hats. And it was wild. It's a lot different perspective for me now, having been a part of the Cubs as well. And you know, thinking about the differences in the two things, but certainly being from New England and knowing, you know, watching 86 and, you know, and seeing how people believed it could never happen. And, you know, watching us, you know, lose a 5-2 lead in game 7 the year before to the Yankees, you know, it was an incredible experience. And I'll never forget, you know, just kind of the driving back from the airport, you know, after we landed, after, you know, being the Cardinals, and just the scene on the way back to the ballpark with everyone getting out of their cars, and, you know, construction workers, you know, cheering from the 18th floor on scaffolding and stuff like that. It was just the most wild scene, watching this whole city just come to a standstill.
About a year later, you and Ben were named co-GMs, December of 2005. Yeah. Theo returned.
Sabbatical.
44 days later, I think it was. How bizarre was that whole situation for you?
It was bizarre. It was, it was incredibly bizarre. I think you could write a book about that offseason, you know. It was a great experience for me in hindsight. You know, looking back on it at that moment in time, there's no way I had the experience necessary to, you know, I had been working in baseball at that point for 2.5, you know, not quite 3 years, and Ben and I are co-GM, but it was, you know, being thrown in the deep end of the pool. And I think for my career, I think the fact that I was able to sort of get a glimpse for 44 days with Ben, you know, with Bill LaJoy, with Craig Shipley, to get that glimpse of what it's like to run a team and then be able to step back and be assistant GM for the next 4 years, you know, it was a great taste of what it would be like. And I think my career really benefited from that 44 days. And also, I had a pretty good sense during that 44 days that Theo was going to come back, and it was a matter of how the negotiations would go. And I was talking to Theo all the time, so I definitely felt like, you know, I might have been in the deep end of the pool, but I had my floaties on to a certain extent with Theo, and I think that was really helpful. But it was great for me, great experience, and it helped me for the next 4 years for sure.
It was a short stint, but an impactful one. You guys exactly. pulled the deal for Beckett and Lowell during those 44 days. How rewarding was it to see that trade work out the way it did?
Yeah, and it was very, very rewarding, and it was also really the way the trade impacted the team was a valuable lesson, because Beckett dropped a 5 ERA the first year. Hanley Ramirez was the rookie of the year, and so it certainly appeared that deal was underwater after year one, and then in year two, you know, Beckett, you know, finished second in the Cy Young, was completely dominant in the postseason. We win the World Series. Lowell's the World Series MVP. So it was a good lesson that, you know, when you make a deal, you know, you have to, you know, you can't worry about every up and down of that deal. You have to sort of, you know, believe in what you did and realize that, like, you know, the first year of a deal that's going to impact you for 4 or 5 years doesn't define the deal. And I think that, you know, that deal didn't look great after 06, looked great after 07.
On the other side of that, when you make a deal that 5 years down the road, you look back and say, man, that was a bad deal.
Mm-hmm.
Corey Kluber comes to mind.
No doubt.
Is that a tough thing to live with? I mean, you also benefit on the other side of that. A guy like the Arrieta deal obviously worked out to your guy's advantage. Is it just part of the job to have to, you know, deal with that?
It's really fascinating, because I think that if you're, you know, if you want to do this job well, you have to take those lessons and really try to learn from them, while at the same time realize that there's an element of this that's out of your control. So, for instance, with Kluber, to this day, I feel terrific about the process that led to that deal. You know, I think we spent so much time, you know, scouting our system. You know, we actually, you know, internally, obviously we were incorrect in our evaluation of him, but felt like we were trying to trade for Ludwig without giving up any of our top guys. And, you know, we felt like we did that, you know, in a year that we didn't expect to contend, we were contending. You know, watching his evolution was fascinating, because he 2010 he went over there to struggle, 2011 he really struggled, I think he had a 5 ERA in AAA as a 25 year old, and then started to come on 12 13 14, I think 14 he won the Cy Young. And so watching his evolution has, you know, made me go back over my notes dozens of times and think about what could have been done differently. But then also having deals that have worked out in a similar way for us, you know, you're sort of always evaluating those two things and weighing those two things. And I always think to myself that in this job, you have to be willing to make deals. And, you know, if you're gun shy and you're afraid of making mistakes, you know, I think that's when you get in trouble, you know. And I think, you know, a deal like Kluber, definitely makes you soul search and think about, you know, where it went wrong. And you know, I'm glad there's deals like Arrieta and Hendricks to, you know, to balance that out. But it's a fascinating one. I'm not gonna lie to you, like, you know, game seven, he beat us in game one and beat us in game four. I didn't want to see us, you know, lose three games to Corey Kluber in the World Series, having made that trade, you know, whatever it was, 6 years earlier.
Right. Before you got the job in San Diego, you interviewed for GM jobs in Pittsburgh and Washington. Guys have told me that the GM interviewing process is quite a thing. How did those two interviews help you prepare and when you finally got the job?
I loved them. You know, the Pittsburgh interview I took during the 2007 season, and you know, I knew Frank Coonley from the commissioner's office. He had just gone over to Pittsburgh, and I liked Frank a lot. And that was the one interview I took that I felt like, you know, I need to have this experience. You know, I don't think I was necessarily ready at that moment to leave Boston, but I wanted to have that experience, and it was a really good thing to go through. You know, the Washington job, you know, that was in 2009. And that was a great process. I think I was in D.C. four different times to interview during that process. And, you know, I definitely wanted that job. My wife was actually in business school at Georgetown at the time. So she was living down there. I love the city, and I love the opportunity because they were, you know, at the bottom. And this looked like a great rebuild. And I think, you know, Mike has done a great job there. It was a great experience to go through having to, you know, it makes you think about what your convictions are. It makes you really prepare your mind in a different way than you do on a day-to-day basis, you know, working for a team. So it was, you know, like I said, it was a great experience. The Washington experience was really good for me, and it did prepare me for interviewing with San Diego.
I asked John Mozeliak like this about one of his early moves as the Cardinals GM was trading Jim Edmonds, who was a real big, real popular player there. In San Diego, you traded Adrian Gonzalez, who obviously was the face of the franchise. Is that a hard thing to do? Or when you look at what you got back, and you know, obviously you like Rizzo, and you ended up having a lot of history with him down the line. But is it tough to go into a place, take over, and wind up trading, you know, essentially the face of the franchise?
It's difficult because I think you know that it's something that's exceptionally unpopular, but at the same time, that was such a clear decision that, you know, you looked at it and you thought to yourself, like, you know, this isn't one that's, you know, an 80-20 decision. This is 100-0. Like, we can't afford this player, and we certainly can't afford to let him walk away and get nothing for him. You know, candidly, when I went into San Diego, I thought there was an exceptionally good chance that you're trading with the deadline in 2010, because if we didn't compete, that's what would have happened. We ended up trading him the winter of you know, 2000, in winter two, before the 2011 season. So it was difficult to realize how disappointed people were that you traded this guy that had, you know, probably five or six great seasons there. He's a hometown kid and a really good ambassador for the Padres. But as far as, you know, decision making, that was actually a really easy decision. And I will say this, you know, in hindsight, you know, Adrian and John Boggs were great to me with that process because, you know, early on, they knew we couldn't sign him. And frankly, they didn't want to sign there if they were going to be a disproportionate percentage of payroll, because they realized that eventually he'd get pushed out to somewhere else where he wouldn't want to be, and I think he wanted to control the process more. So they were great to work with during that process because, you know, we came to a conclusion pretty early on, like, okay, this simply isn't going to work for either side, and, you know, let's just go ahead. You know, let's just know that we're going to part somehow.
When you left San Diego, you said you weren't looking to leave.
No.
What tipped the scales for you? Was it the opportunity to join Theo with the Cubs a no-brainer when that presented itself?
I wouldn't say it was a no-brainer because I love San Diego, and it was, you know, I did love the, you know, what we were building, and I felt like we were on the right track. I love the staff that we brought in. I mean, I don't think you just pour yourself into something for 2 years, you know, don't see it to conclusion and say leaving is a no-brainer. I think that part was really difficult. But 2004 had been such an incredible life experience for me. There's one more chance in sports to do it. And so I think that part of it was, you know, how do I turn down an opportunity to do something I never thought I'd experience again on a really actually even bigger stage than Boston. So that part certainly tipped it. And listen, I, you know, the opportunity to work with Theo and Jason in a different setting was really great. You know, I think Theo and I talked a lot about, you know, not only doing it, but doing it, you know, kind of the same group of people. You know, it was really exciting. But yeah, I don't think you can pour yourself into something for 2 years and say it's a no-brainer. But the Cubs is such an—I mean, I feel so incredibly fortunate that the Cubs job presented itself, because it's such an incredible opportunity.
The dynamics of your front office a little different with you, with Theo. Does your long-standing relationship with him make this work easier than it might if it was somebody you didn't have that history with?
Yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't work if you don't have prior experience, but I don't think I ever could have entered this relationship with someone else. You know, I think that, you know, I'd gone from, you know, the final decision maker in San Diego to number two here. And so sort of giving up some of that authority, you know, I knew that'd be challenging at some level, but I also knew that with my relationship with Theo, that I would, you know, our trust level and the autonomy that he would give me would be there. So I do think it's a really good front office structure for the way baseball teams are run these days, but it's not without risk, because if you get two people, you know, you sort of two people that are looking to run things, and two people that are have strong personalities and egos, frankly, I think it can be a structure that can lead to some big challenges.
Someone actually wrote, your job requires big ideas but a small ego. It seems like you'd agree with that.
But my role?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, but it's made a lot easier by working with Theo. I mean, look at this guy, like, you know, if you could fast track someone to the Hall of Fame, you'd do it. And so I look at it as an opportunity. You know, I've been incredibly lucky to work with him for 13 of the last 15 years and to learn from him and to sort of be a partner with him in this process. So, you know, long term, I think my benefit from this relationship is incredible. And I've learned so much from being around him. And so, yeah, so if the ego has to take a step back for that, it's definitely going to be well worth it, not only now, but I think well into the future.
It seems like this arrangement is becoming more common, though,
yeah,
around the league. You look at the Dodgers, mm-hmm, the Twins, the Rays. There are a number of teams that have this similar, yeah, type of thing. Why do you think baseball is starting to trend in that direction?
I just think that the job is getting bigger and bigger. You know, I think there's more information in the game today. There's more media in the game today. So there's more things pulling at, you know, the final decision maker. And I think having someone that sort of has, you know, in my case certainly has done the job before, sort of, you know, it allows, you know, multiple people to be tackling the same project. And, you know, that's not a certainly no knock on all the great, you know, GMs that have worked in different eras, but I do think, you know, with technology, information, media, it's a bigger thing to get your arms around now.
If you're enjoying this Mark Feinsand interview, make sure you check out all the great conversations featured in the MLB.com Newsmakers podcast. You'll hear Mark and other MLB.com reporters chat with baseball's brightest stars of today and the past, as well as the game's best broadcasters and writers. You can download MLB.com Newsmakers today on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts by searching Newsmakers. Now, back to Mark Feinsand.
You acquired Rizzo in San Diego. You come to Chicago. You acquire Rizzo in Chicago. What was it about him that stood out so much as a prospect?
Yeah. I think finding that, you know, as a player, sort of the combination of power and hitting ability was really appealing. You know, this left-handed hitter with power that also has the ability to control the barrel and is a good hitter was really appealing. But so much of the conviction was as a person, you know, that he's one of the guys you felt like, you know, has it. He's just not going to let himself fail. He's always making adjustments. I remember when we acquired him from the Red Sox, obviously I still had a ton of connections with the Red Sox at the time. It's the number of texts I got from people just, you know, really disappointed to see him go, but also completely convicted this guy was going to be a big-time middle-of-the-order bat and excellent defender. Was really telling. You know, I don't think I've ever acquired any player and had that many people sort of behind the scenes like, oh, I love this guy. This guy's, you know, this guy's got it. And, you know, we were excited to get him in that deal. Theo didn't want to give him up. I mean, Theo loves Riz. He didn't want to give him up. But it was just you're acquiring a first baseman and you know, signing him to a 7-year extension when David Ortiz is your DH. You know, Rizzo was such an obvious, easy inclusion in that deal. But, you know, Theo always loved him. It was just, you know, Adrian helped him win right away. And frankly, Adrian was a perfect fit for that ballpark, too, you know, the way he hits. And then, the trade here was just, you know, I remember sitting at lunch with my wife when I found out that the Padres had traded, you know, Latos to Cincinnati and they'd gotten Yonder Alonso in the deal, and like the first thing that snaps in your mind is, oh my goodness, Rizzo might be available. So certainly when we got over here, we came over here at the end of October, you know, so you kind of go through, you know, all of our planning in November. You know, no point did anyone say, hey, let's go get Rizzo. I mean, well, he wasn't available. He was going to be the Padres' first baseman. And then all of a sudden that deal happened, and we knew he might be available. And so, you know, we worked at it for about a month. And, you know, I think the Padres had some good offers. I was glad they picked ours.
His first 49 or 50 games didn't go very well.
Yeah.
How much conviction do you need to have as an executive and your belief in a guy to just say, that's okay, this guy's going to figure it out?
Yeah. It was actually, that was an area where it was really great to have Theo, because Jason and I had watched it. You know, we watched him dominate in AAA that year and then brought him up and he really struggled and the swing got kind of long. And it was really great. That was one area it was really great to have Theo, because he was like, he hadn't watched every at-bat, you know, and he was like, who cares? You know, I mean, so you look at the number of players that have struggled for, you know, 49, 50 games, it's endless number of Hall of Famers, right, that have come up and struggled. And, you know, it sometimes it's good to have that total outsider's perspective of like, I didn't watch it, so what? Like, this guy's gonna be a great hitter. I don't have to worry about, you know, what a 21-year-old does in Petco Park in his first 50 games or so.
The Cubs took a big step forward in 15, got to the NLCS. When last year did you feel like this team was ready to take the next step?
Last year?
Or even in 15. When did you look at this team and think, we're ready to take that step?
I think sort of the timeline for us was, I always tell people, the middle of 14, after the draft, after the Russell trade, that was sort of the moment where, like, wow, like, we actually feel like we're really talented, and it's going to take some time. I don't know how long it's going to take, but kind of looking at the guys we had in the minor leagues, it felt really good. And then we actually played about 500 baseball in August and September of 14.
Yeah, what was
and that 2 months gave us the conviction to go out and go get Lester and Montero and Fowler. Because I think if we didn't, I think we'd really struggle at the end of 14. I think we would have said, okay, let's wait till 16 to go out and sort of try to push our team forward. But because we had all those prospects and because we played well at the end of the year, we said, okay, let's try to push this team forward in 15. And you know, we always talk about not getting caught in the middle, but we felt like we probably thought it was inevitable to have a season in the middle on the way up. And so we thought going into 2015, we thought, okay, this team is, we felt like it was a team that we could win in the low to mid 80s.
Yeah.
And if everything went right, maybe we could have a puncher's chance at competing. Yeah. But I don't think anyone certainly was expecting 97 wins. I think that was something that came together in a way that was a lot different than we expected.
I remember talking to you after game 7. You almost didn't have words to describe what was going on. When did it set in? When did it set into you that you guys have won the World Series?
Yeah. So I always tell people that the night of game 7 was just relief. You know, that I think my emotions after game 7 would have been totally different if, you know, Rajah Davis flies out and we win the game 6-4. I think
right.
that your emotions are a lot different. I think having the game, you know, played out the way it did, I felt like just it was such a sigh of relief that entire night. You know, yeah, we celebrated and everything, but it was just, felt like relief. And then it actually started sinking in the next day. We were all just hanging out in the bleachers. It was like this odd 70-degree early November day in Chicago. You know, we all kind of went home and slept, and then we came into the ballpark, and we were hanging out in the bleachers just enjoying ourselves and throwing a football around. And it was a pretty cool moment. And then obviously the next day we had the parade. And I remember the parade in 2004. One of the greatest memories I ever had. And I remember telling my wife as we were leaving the house, I'm like, this is going to be awesome. I was so excited. And it so far surpassed anything I ever could have imagined in terms of the number of people and the excitement. So, yeah, I started thinking the next day, and then the parade certainly solidified it. And, you know, I know the players had talked all year. Like, the parade was always this kind of symbol of, like, you know, like, you know, can we have this parade in Chicago? The fact that it was able to come together in 2 days and be even greater than everyone imagined, I think that's something that no one will ever forget, having been a part of it, because it was so much bigger than even the greatest expectations you could have. And the more, as much as you allowed yourself to think about it during the rebuild, it was that much better.
No duck boats, though.
No duck boats. And, you know, the parade in Boston was so incredible. It was so loud. You know, it was the exact same emotion. The only difference in Chicago is more people. There's just that many more people.
Every team at this point has an analytics department.
Yeah.
To whatever extent they use it, obviously some teams are different. Yeah. Do you think teams are out there now looking for the next thing?
Yeah.
Now that analytics have caught up?
You have to. Yeah, I mean, I think that when I first got into the game, the competitive advantages on that level were much easier. You know, they would last longer. Many teams simply didn't believe in it. So if you had a belief in analytics, you know, it could carry you a long way towards the kind of players you could acquire. You know, I always look back on the 2002, the offseason from 2002 to 2003. You know, we acquired Millar and Bill Miller and David Ortiz, you know, for really almost no investment. Todd Walker, and then the next year we got Mark Bellhorn. If you wanted that kind of player, they were available. You know, and then that's not the case anymore. So now I just think that the competitive teams are run in a much more similar way. The world analytically is much flatter, but it doesn't mean it's less important. It just means that whatever those competitive advantages might be, there's kind of smaller margins on those advantages.
Statcast has made a lot of the analytics more widely available to the public now.
Yeah.
You think it's changing the way fans are looking at the game?
Yeah, I think in a good way. I mean, I think that it's. You know, I love it. Like, a guy hits a home run now, and you're like, how hard did he hit that? Or the guy lines out to second or something, and you're like, oh, that was 108 miles an hour off the bat. And I do think that it's gonna change the way this next generation views baseball. But I think that's a positive. I think that it adds another layer to our evaluation. And I do think that it will, not yet, but I think in time, you know, as we get better and better and better at it, I think that it will shine a light on a lot of players that previously would have been ignored. You know, I think that a great base runner or a great defender will probably get his due now. Whereas they think for a long time, not because anyone didn't believe in those things, but they couldn't quantify them. And so things that you can't quantify aren't believed in, like homers and RBIs and runs scored and things like that. And so, you know, a super impactful defender or a super impactful base runner now, I think will get the credit he probably has always deserved.
You guys are working towards this goal of bringing a championship to Chicago. You did that. How hard was it to get back to work and start looking at 17?
It happened so fast. I mean, you know, we had decisions to make right away. You know, I think Saturday, we won the World Series on Wednesday night with the parade on Friday, and on Saturday, Theo and I went and met with Jason Hamill and his wife to talk about his option, and on Sunday, we flew out to Arizona to the GM meetings, and I think the nature of playing deep in the season, you don't get a break. To me, the off season was incredible. You know, yes, we had a lot of work, but just the number of cool things that happened, whether it's just a person coming up to you in a restaurant and saying thank you and talking about, you know, whether they're, you know, their grandfather and father and all this stuff. Like, those are so rewarding to the White House visit. You know, it was a really cool offseason. I think by the time we got to Arizona, it was very much like, okay, that was great. That was really fun. But now it's time to play another season. This is our job. We play baseball. You know, we watch baseball. We talk about baseball. And, you know, you can't push pause and have the endless offseason. I mean, we have to get back to work. And that was the sense I got from every player that we met with coming in, that they had the same experience. It was an amazing offseason. It was a whirlwind. But let's get back to playing.
You saw the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry change a little bit after 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get the sense Cardinals-Cubs is going to change a little bit now?
Yeah, I think it, you know, it does. I think that, you know, the whatever year you were on at the time, you know, 83 years, 85 years, 86 years in 2004, like, I think that was always the easy comeback, right? It was always every argument ended with that. Every sign mentioned it, you know, and I think it was the same thing with the Cardinals, understandably. So, yeah, I think it does change things, but it's a great rivalry. I said this when we got here, that the Red Sox, the Yankees made the Red Sox better when we got there in 2002. You know, we had this unbelievable team to chase. I mean, I was alive, but I certainly wasn't a baseball fan, you know, in 75, 76 for the Reds. But certainly in my lifetime as a baseball fan, you know, the 98 Yankees are certainly the best team and what you sort of aspire to be. And we were sort of taking over, that those guys were maturing and, you know, the team was changing, but certainly the team that had won, you know, in 98, 99, 2000 was largely together, and that was what we had to beat in order to win the division. That's what we had to, you know, to do in, you know, to get past in order to win the World Series. It made us better. You know, it sort of sharpened our focus and made us have higher goals. And I think that was really important. And I think the Cardinals did the exact same thing, you know, for us. You know, we came over here. I flew into Chicago. We had our press conference. You know, my wife's family's from, they're all Cardinals fans, they're all from St. Louis. And I remember I jumped on a plane to fly back to San Diego. I missed game six. I was in the air and I didn't have a TV on the plane. And I watched game seven on the night of my father-in-law's 60th birthday. And they won the World Series as we were just arriving here. You know, 2012, I think they're up 3-1 against the Giants. 2013, they were in the World Series. So our introduction to Chicago was these terrific Cardinal teams, great farm system, great major league guys, great leadership, and that's what we have to get past to win the division. You know, it made us better, and I think that's what a really good rivalry does. It makes you set your sights higher. It makes you have higher goals, and I don't think we get to where we did in 2016 without having the Cardinals in our division. So I think it helps us, and I think it's going to work the same way on both directions now.
Seeing Dexter Fowler sign with the Cardinals reminded me of Damon signing with the Yankees. Is it tough not only to lose a guy who was such an integral part of your team, but to see him go to your division rivals?
Yeah. You know, Dex is wonderful. You know, I had 2 great years with Dexter. I think him signing back with us last year was just amazing, galvanizing thing for our team. You know, we spent all of January talking about, if we bring this guy back, how do we possibly get him enough at bats? And then game 3, Schwarber blows out his knee, and now it's wide open, and Dexter plays all year and has the best year of his career, and, you know, homers to lead off game 7, and all these different things. It was like a storybook year for him. And, you know, we'll miss him. I think he's always going to be a part of, you know, the team that, you know, broke the drought. Just like Damon will always be the guy that homered twice in game 7 against the Yankees. And I always had a ton of respect for Johnny. And it's the same thing with Dexter. I think it is very similar. But, I mean, I think in this game, you realize, you know, when guys become free agents, they can go anywhere. And, you know, we knew they were in search of a center fielder. So it was no surprise that he ended up there. It's going to be weird seeing him in red 19 times a year. But, listen, I hope he plays great and we win.
Why is Joe Maddon the ideal manager for this team?
I think he's ideal for this team for a couple reasons. And the first reason is that he had this experience in Tampa. You know, I think, you know, obviously the players are different, but I think, you know, I remember in 07 playing against the Rays and feeling like, man, like, if these guys have a bullpen, if these guys can get a couple more pieces, they're going to be really good because, you know, Longoria was on the way. You know, Crawford was such an impact player. You know, Upton was an impact player. And you just like, see the pieces on the field, and you're kind of getting a little bit nervous. Like, I don't know how soon it's going to come together, but you could kind of feel the talent mounting on the border, so to speak, with Tampa. And then Joe kind of pushed them into a winning situation, you know, in 2008. So he saw how this kind of young group could come together, and he was a big part of that. And I just felt like that was 2015, I think, to me, was he came in, he really believed in this young group. I always say he was a really early believer in the 2015 team. You know, I'd go in his office after games. We'd be playing against, you know, a good team. We'd play against a Giants or Dodgers or Pirates or Cardinals or Nationals, whomever. And he'd be like, we can play with these guys. Like, we can play with these guys. We're just as talented. They're just older and more experienced, and we can play with these guys. And I think that confidence in our team really meant a lot in 15. I think in 16, our guys thought they were good, right? But he believed that they were good before they were, and I think that was really important. So that's one reason, is that I think his experience watching 07 to 08 Rays made a big difference in his belief in those guys. The second thing is I just feel like his personality, you know, he was able in some ways to take some of the burden off the young players in 2015. Because, you know, listen, Joe can be a quote machine at times. And he definitely takes a lot of the media pressure off those guys and it kind of took it on himself. And I think that was really important in 2015 that he give the Russells and Bryants and Baezes and Solares and some of those guys a little bit of, you know, room. And I think in a huge market like Chicago with this weight of expectations, I think his personality is the same guy every day. He's, you know, kind of has a skip in his step every single day. He's loose. He doesn't have a lot of rules. He doesn't, nothing he does amplifies the pressure at all. He lessens it and he doesn't amplify it. And I think that's really important for a team that's trying to do something that's really difficult, because I do think that trying to break a curse like that, there are things you deal with that other questions you have to answer that other people don't have to. And I think Tito in Boston was very much the same thing. And when I think back on where Tito and Joe really similar, it is a very loose feeling, and loose and positive and steady feeling every single day. And I don't think it's a mistake that those are the two guys that have broken these curses, because I do think that the guy that holds it a little bit too tight, he might succeed in a certain environment. I don't think that guy is going to succeed in an environment where there's going to be some tightness because of what you're trying to accomplish.
Just a few more left here. Oh, yeah. I appreciate your time. Jason Heyward's first season did not go as well as he had hoped, or as you had hoped, I'm sure. Did the World Series title take a little pressure off of him heading into this year, do you think?
I think so. I think that, to Jason's incredible credit, I think a lot of times when you see a first-year free agent struggle in a new environment, which is, I've seen happen a lot, it happens, and a lot of guys can kind of go in their shell, isolate themselves from the group, kind of, feel like they're not part of it. He's such an amazing teammate. He contributes in so many other ways. It's not the least bit surprising to me that he would be the one that calls a meeting, and he'd be the most vocal guy. And also the fact that he has such gravitas with his teammates that he'd be able to call that meeting. Kind of like I mentioned, talking about, you look at trades and you have to sort of take a step back sometimes and realize like they might not go great early on. And I think, he's a young guy. He's had a ton of success in the big leagues. And so, his first year didn't go as he hoped, but, we got a lot more baseball for him to play here. And I am really happy that the fans totally respect, what he's done for the team so far, what he's sacrificed, how hard he's worked. And I think that gives him, I think he's going to be a fan favorite once he, kind of clicks back offensively to where it was.
Wade Davis is one of the bigger acquisitions for the winter for you guys. How important was it to you to bring in a proven closer after watching Chapman, after letting Chapman leave as a free agent?
Yeah, certainly having a guy like Chapman, it makes you sort of realize what that kind of late inning, dominant force can mean. We don't win the World Series without Chapman. There's no way. I think, with any World Series, everyone focuses so much on how it ended, how we got there, like the eight out save in a one run game, in elimination game in game five. We needed someone like that to be able to get to game seven. And certainly going into the offseason, we felt like closure was something that was really important for us to have. I think, I always say, we're gonna have a lot of leads. And I say that with all humility. Like, we're a good team, we're gonna have a lot of leads. Our pitching staff, our defense, a lot of games are going to be very close. And so it is important to, have a team that preserves those. There's nothing more frustrating in baseball than playing for 2.5 hours and being ahead and then losing in the last 30 minutes. I think that everyone, that kind of tears the heart out of a team. So, investing in guys like Davis and Uehara, and then we have some other really good bullpen guys that we bring back, it is really important for the way baseball is run today.
People always talk about the championship hangover. What's your biggest concern heading into this year?
I think with a lot of teams, I think there's a concern about you know, entitlement, complacency, things like that. I don't worry about that with this group. We have such a young and hungry group, and our veterans have won a lot, and so I think that, you know, those guys are still hungry. I think what you worry about is, I look at it like, it's really hard to win once, you know, that, you know, last year we were really fortunate. You know, we thought we had the best team coming out of spring training. We stayed really healthy throughout the season. We were healthy going into October. We've got some breaks along the way. And so, you know, I look at it like we felt like we were the best team, and it still took us to the 10th inning of Game 7 to win the World Series. It's hard to win once. I think that's always the biggest challenge in baseball, right? That, you know, Villanova won the national title last year, and they were number one seed. They get bounced in the second round. You know, their guys didn't try less hard. They weren't complacent. They had a great season. It's just things happen over the course of a year. Injuries, bad luck. Other teams are good that you play against. So, I mean, I always think when you win once, it always makes me look at, like, the Yankee teams in the late 90s or the Reds teams, the A's, whatever, all these teams that have been able to win a bunch of times. It makes me hold those teams in such incredibly high regard, because you do realize, like, wow, what winning three titles in a row, like, that's just an unbelievable accomplishment. So the nature of baseball is probably my biggest concern, and health. We stayed really healthy last year, and I hope it happens again. But it's our job to, you know, assume the worst and try to buy insurance for all the different possibilities. And, you know, that's the reality. It's hard to stay healthy year after year.
Rookie of the Year in 2015, MVP in 2016. What can Chris Bryant do to follow that up this year?
I think he'll be better. You know, I think that's the beauty of Chris Bryant, is that, you know, Chris, going back to something we talked about at the very beginning, like, Chris loves baseball, and he loves trying to get better. And he said it to me earlier this year, like, the fun of baseball is trying to get better. And I think every year he's going to go home in the offseason and try to figure out what thing in his game can he do better, you know, to have a better year the next year. So if you ask Chris, I'd be like, you know, is this the pinnacle? Have you had your best year? He's like, no chance. And I think that he went home this offseason, and what did he work on? He worked on, like, getting back to the opposite field power he's had in the past. You know, he pulled, like, 38 out of 39 homers last year, which is very different than what he was in the minor leagues. And, you know, I think that when you have a guy that's driven like that, who thinks that improving is fun, and, like, you know, tinkering is fun, I think he's going to have some monster years, and I think after those monster years, he's going to go back and try to get better. And I think that's why I think he's going to be a superstar. He is a superstar.
What's your assessment of the state of the NL Central this year, and do you think it'll feel different being the hunted rather than the hunters?
No, because I think we were the hunted last year. As I said before, I mean, the Cardinals are good every year. That they've figured out the sustained success thing, you know, and I think last year they were a team that, you know, 2016 wasn't their year. You know, they couldn't get on a hot streak. It felt like 10 games over 500 was this weird glass ceiling for them, and they were a better team than that. And I expect them to come back really strong this year, and Dexter will help them. But no, they're a really good team, great organization, and the Pirates too. I mean, the Pirates, you know, they won 98 games 2 years ago. They have great young talent, and I love the way they play. I think that it's I give Clint and his staff a ton of credit. They play with a ton of swagger and a ton of energy, and I always like watching them from the other side. I think it'll be a good race. And listen, I think that I see a lot of what we did in the Cubs and Brewers. You know, they're taking a longer view of it.
Reds.
What did I say?
Cubs.
Oh, I said, yeah, the Brewers and Reds. I see a lot of the Cubs and the Brewers and Reds, yep, and what they're doing. And, you know, it's not going to be long until, you know, I'm talking about them alongside the Cardinals and Pirates, because they've made a lot of good acquisitions. They've got some high draft picks, and it feels like they're on the right track.